This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
As we all know, or as I hope we all know at this point, we are gathered here today on stolen Aboriginal lands, specifically the lands of the Kulin... Sorry. The Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I'd like to acknowledge their elders, past, present and future, as well as extend my respects to any First Nations people with us today. I think for those of us who are settlers here, and I think that would be most of us, it's important to go beyond kind of just a tokenistic acknowledgement at the start of an event like this one, and to firstly acknowledge our settler privilege and what it's allowed us to achieve in being here, in working and playing in these spaces, but to go beyond that and to take actions in solidarity. There's a lot of things that you can be doing, that we can all be doing, to work in solidarity with First Nations people of this land. For example, I hope most of you will be familiar with the Japurong protests that are happening. They're trying to destruct sacred 800-year-old trees up near Ararat, and bodies are needed on the ground. We needed to call politicians, donate money. There's a lot of actions you can take. That's just one of them, something to think about. Hi, my name's Hella, and with us is Ruby and Celeste. I'll let you two introduce yourselves.
Okay, hi, Ruby Hamid. I'm the author of White Tears, Brown Scars, and thank you all for joining me. Thank you for the acknowledgement, which is especially pertinent given the topic that we're discussing. And I know that it's being a woman of colour and a non-Indigenous woman of colour, it's a terrain that we do have to walk between how can we discuss our experiences and our perspectives on these issues without, speaking over the First Nations women and First Nations people in general. And I was, aware of that while writing, and I do hope that I didn't cross that line. And if it has, then, this is a learning experience, definitely. But, it is complex terrain, and I do think it's important for all, women of colour to be able to talk. And I think it's something we're just discovering together when it's, appropriate and when it's not.
Hi, everyone. I'm Celeste Little. I'd also like to begin by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and paying my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging, as well as paying my respects to the current traditional owners, in fact, all over Victoria, who are some of the staunchest and proudest people who I've ever seen and who have inspired me so much. I'm an Urundu woman from Central Australia. My traditional lands are pretty much Alice Springs and southeast of there. I was born, though, on Ngunnawal country in Canberra, and have lived in Melbourne, first on Bunurong land and then Wurundjeri land for the past... How old am I? for the past 27 odd years, so been here a while. Just by way of additional intro, I'm a columnist for Eureka Street. I'm a freelancer for a lot of other places, and I'm a trade unionist. So yeah, that's me.
So we're here to discuss your book. I'm sure everybody's got a copy. If you don't, there will be sales, I think, at the end, and Ruby will be signing copies. White Tears, Brown Scars. I know you've been doing a lot of panels and a lot of work around this lately, so you're probably sick of saying this, but just in case anybody here isn't familiar, can you let us know what was the impetus for the book? How did it come about?
So the book came out of an article I wrote for The Guardian last May, last year, how white women use strategic tears to silence women of colour, which went completely unexpectedly, globally viral, and a lot of backlash, but also a lot of support from women of colour across, you know, from across Australia and you know, the US in particular, and sort of saying, yes, we finally, they've known this is happening, but they finally saw it in a mainstream publication acknowledged in that space. And it was women of colour who urged me to keep the conversation going. For me, it was, okay, I was doing my PhD. This kind of thing's been happening to me a lot, and I'm talking to other women. I'm seeing that it's happening to them, and I'm seeing tweets from Black women in America talking about their experiences at work. So I was like, is there some sort of connection here? Is this systemic, or is this just something that happens sometimes? And, you know, it was not just in the response to the... It was in the... Before writing the article, I was thinking, this is happening so often, it deserves to be spoken about more. And then the response to the article was like, OK, this is absolutely systemic. And so a lot of women asked me, keep this conversation going. Like, you're in a position now because you've said it and it's there, and keep it going. And so I was like, gosh, is there a book in this? And then I was like, how do I write a book on this? And but then once you start the research, it's like, there's like 50 books on this. But yeah, so it was about condensing it.
Yeah, speaking of the research, we will get into the content, but I'm actually, yeah, really curious as to know how you went about the research, because there's a lot in the book, right? There's even, like, small mentions. The one thing that stuck with me, I think, early on is a line about a woman who gets raped in broad daylight in public. I cannot remember when, but early 1900s, I want to say. And I jumped on, like, I'm like, that's... How? Jumped on Google, Googled it, did not come up with any results, so I'm assuming it's like part of National Archives or something. But can you tell us a bit about the research?
Okay, so I think the one you're talking about is in Southern Rhodesia, and I got that from one of the texts I used for that part of the book, which was Black Peril, White Virtue. Mm. Or White Virtue, Black Peril, my bad. So yeah, I got that from that book, and I would have loved to go into the archives, but there wasn't that much time, and I'm also not an experienced historian, so I relied on the research of others. And in most, you know, when I could, in most cases, I tried to use the research of women from, you know, in the communities. So when I talked about, you know, the treatment of Indigenous First Nations women here, I looked at, first and foremost, the work of Indigenous women. And the same goes with, we're talking about, you know, Black women in the US, and sort of filled in the gaps with others. So it was a lot of reading textbooks, or not textbooks, but reading texts by historians, by critical thinkers, and then using that to sort of to synthesise and bring it all together. To try to find some common threads, and, you know, by no means to try to imply that all women of colour and Indigenous women's experiences are the same. They're absolutely not. And I discussed it at the start of the book, the complicated relationship I have with some of these terms, you know, and I'm aware of all that.
Yeah, they can be homogenising, can't they?
It can, and it's tough. So what I try to do in the book is, okay, when I'm talking about something that is general enough that it can apply to all, women, no matter what their background, then I'll use a term like women of colour or Black and brown women. When it's something that's specific, then there's a great responsibility and in honesty, you have to be specific that's who you're talking about, because that doesn't apply to everyone.
Mm-hmm. And how did you find, so I saw a tweet the other day and I could not find it, so I could not have to like half paraphrase it off the top of my head because I'm terrible at paraphrasing, but I saw a tweet the other day that was kind of talking about how so much of history or history books is actually written by white people. And there are a myriad of reasons for that. We could like have an entirely different panel talking just about that. But it did say, like, in part, one of the reasons would be that delving into this kind of history is quite painful. And like, I, reading this book was quite painful in some parts. So to, you know, white historians have the luxury of not having to take a minute to breathe and grieve and do all of that. So, yeah, I'm just wondering, like, and I guess that question could be extended to you as well, like, in the course of your writing, how do you find the process of writing this and the process of researching it?
I'll throw to Celeste if she...
I didn't necessarily find reading the book painful. It was For me, it was more affirming of processes that I go through to write a lot of this stuff. When you're continually delving in, I don't know the best way to put this, but when it comes to Australia specifically and digging and trying to find the history of this place, a lot of that trauma that I've felt is stuff that I've had to deal with quite a number of years ago, because there is so much that we're not taught here, purposefully so. It's to maintain that white power sort of notion of terra nullius, land belonging to no one, and that imposed rule on top of a group of people who had been here for millennia beforehand. And we're not taught those things because it doesn't serve the purpose of maintaining that rule to teach them. So the process of unpacking that for me has been a lifelong adulthood journey, and asking that question, why aren't we taught this, why aren't we taught that? Delving into various other, I guess what I get from looking at other circumstances from black people, from brown people, from Indigenous peoples all across the world, is where there's similarities in that sort of experience of colonisation and where there's differences and what those differences are. So it's, more than anything, what I find painful is not so much digging in the history, it's the fact that we always end up back at the exact same spot a year later, playing the same arguments, trying to convince a bunch of people that our lives and our liberties and all of that are actually important. We end up explaining racism 101 over and over and over again.
Yeah, I was definitely thinking of you as well, some others, when I was writing that bit where we're expected to be content with just repeating ourselves again and again with no thought as to, the effect on us as writing it, having to write the same thing again and again, and also how demoralising it is that it's not really changing. So what's it for, what's it all for? But in terms of researching, there's a lot of horror, and I tried not to delve and be descriptive in that. And you have to compartmentalize in many ways to be like, okay, I have to read this because I have to know. I don't necessarily have to relay everything on, but you have to know the extent of it. But there was also a lot of fascination is not the right word, but almost in how different but how similar it was in the way in which black women and enslaved black and African women were treated under slavery and Indigenous women here, and then the parallels with Indigenous women here and in North America with the child removals, and it's the same, and the same rationales, the same justifications given without necessarily much communication in between. And if that's the case, if the same things are playing out without it being a conspiracy, then you have to look at, well, where is it coming from? And where is it coming from was the construction of what is a white person? What is a white man? What is a white woman? And then anyone who doesn't match that is basically inferior and we can do as we wish because, well, they're not as good as us. They're not like us. And it's okay for us
they're
to do this.
Human.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, it's funny you bring up the repetition because I think you actually address that later in the book. It's, we do often, you mention Audre Lorde, you mention bell hooks, and even further back into history where we are just repeating the same thing over and over, and it is in effect how white supremacy maintains itself, isn't it? Like if you apologize one day, and then you also brought up the apology, and then in 2008, and then fast forward a few years and somebody is writing an article about how colonization was good, this current environment that we find ourselves in, that's you can publish an article. It boggles the mind that you can even publish an article like that.
So we can go from 2008, we acknowledge government culpability for Stolen Generations, we apologise, and then, a decade later, being like, well, they were trying to be nice. I'm not going to mention the columnist who wrote it, but that's literally, I think a lot of you would know who I'm talking about, and I do discuss it in the book. Like, you can't, you know, sure, they were misguided, but they're trying to, it's like, no. You can't take us backwards like that. Like, you can't go from being like, yes. And which is not to say that the apology in itself, and you know, Celeste can speak to this more than I can, is enough, but it's a minimum to progress from.
Yeah, I mean, the apology was as simple as an acknowledgement. Mm. You know, after so long, and it had been a hard fought for acknowledgement. It was an acknowledgement that had been waited for 10 years from the Bring Them Home report, the tabling of that, and it had been a really weighted one because it was initially put on John Howard as the Prime Minister of the day to do it, and his continual refusal. You know, the apology was incredibly well worded. I think a lot of Aboriginal people at the time found some sort of sense of perhaps there's a beginning of healing there. But we also felt deeply cheated after it, you know, because straight away any sort of talk of compensation was cut off. Any sort of forward momentum so that we weren't going back to the sorts of policies and rhetoric that that led to those numbers of children being removed. We were hoping that sort of stuff wouldn't be repeated. To then look at child removal rates now, which are in some places exceeding what they were during the height of the Stolen Generations, and to find out that in places like New South Wales it's even easier for this to occur, even though there was, you know, following the apology, there were promises that never again, and there was definitely, you know, commitment that they'd work more with communities, to find out that this isn't the case and it's still going on and it gets worse and worse. And then we've got white commentators effectively sanitising the entire thing and talking about good intentions and that is just mind-boggling.
Mm. Yeah, as I said, whiteness will find a way to maintain itself. I did want to make a note of this. I don't know if this happens. I mean, I'm sure it does happen to both of you, but anytime I find myself speaking to whiteness, I often find that I have to defend myself. I don't hate white people. Mm. Like, you know, let me just caveat, like, hashtag not all white people. I don't hate you personally. I, like, hate whiteness as a, you know, ideological structure and, like, really, like, but, you know, I don't hate you. I'm sure you're fine. But so I just wanted to kind of throw in that caveat before. And I'm going to read a section of your book here, but... Yeah, where it's not so much people that I dislike, although I do dislike people who perpetuate that system. But when we speak of white people or whiteness, we are speaking to the structure as opposed to you personally. But you do say in your book, and I hope, look, I actually have an uncorrected proof, so hopefully I'm not going to read anything that hasn't, like, been changed.
Too many changes,
that's good. I mean, it was pretty good as I read it. Okay, I have to angle this with the light. So you say, whiteness is more than skin colour. It is a system that privileges those racial, cultural and religious identities that most resemble the typical characteristics associated with the white Western Europeans who created the system in their image. And this system of white supremacy is now so ingrained it can exist without white people. So yeah, just throwing that out as a caveat, just in case. But I did want to talk a little bit about, I guess the thesis of the book, white feminism. White women in particular. I thought it was actually really interesting. So the first half of this book, for people who haven't read it, or the first part of the book, kind of goes into how the concept of white womanhood got to be, basically, which it was quite an education for me, I think, because I've never really considered how white womanhood was created. Again, because I can't paraphrase, I'm just going to read this off my phone. Mainstream Western feminism cannot be anything more than another iteration of white supremacy. Reminds me of a 2016 spoken word poem by Rachel Wiley called The Dozens, where she says, intersectional feminism, aka actual fucking feminism, plays the dozens with white feminism. White feminism doesn't appreciate being called white feminism. White feminism thinks your obsession with race is frankly divisive. White feminism swears she will unlock the door to equality and let us all in if we just hoist her through this window on our backs. And ain't that just like white feminism, always getting up on someone else's back? So can you speak a little to how white feminism in these and other ways works to maintain the status quo? and how it differs from intersectional feminism, and how white women who love putting intersectional feminist in their Twitter and Tinder bios and T-shirts can actually put that concept into practice.
Yeah.
Comes up a lot, doesn't
it? Questions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, so I didn't.
I like to look, like, when I think of, like, you know, feminism, you know, and what we now call intersectional feminism, I think of it as global feminism. So it's a feminism, and some academic circles call it transnational feminism, which is another very academic word, and global sounds a little less, you know, a little more accessible. So it's, and that really means you have to think of it globally, which means necessarily you have to acknowledge that the experiences are not all the same, and that, which is the fundamentals of intersectional theory, and also that acknowledgement that gender is not the only sort of locus, the only sign of oppression that women face. So that's the rest of that quote that Hella read out at the beginning of, was until white women acknowledge that, then it's always is going to be another, you know, a form of white supremacy, because they're going to be, sure, elevating themselves and maybe taking a few chosen women of colour with them. However, the system is still in place because it hasn't acknowledged that whiteness has achieved what it's achieved at the expense of the people that it's colonised, and then the people that have come from other countries, many of whom themselves were fleeing colonization, and we all then become embroiled in the system, and that's why we still, we talk about gender diversity, but it's almost always white women, and when a woman of color that tries to in any way critique, it's easy in a way. You do get a lot of abuse, obviously, but in some ways it's much easier to critique the right as a woman of colour, because you're going to have the support of progressives, right? They're going to be like, yay, we love it when you. But as soon as you sort of turn around, like, oh, actually, you know, you guys can sort of maybe do this, do that, and then it's like, what? You get edged out. You start to get squeezed out. You're not allowed to go there. Don't criticize. Don't bite the hand that feeds you, almost. But if that's the case, then there's an implicit acknowledgement of an imbalance in power. If I'm not allowed to ever criticize you, even if it's constructive, and then I pay the price by being, you know, losing work opportunities or being squeezed out of friendship circles or being isolated at work, then that's an acknowledgement that there's an inferiority superiority sort of going on that's not acknowledged openly. Mm. And so in terms of, you know, white women billing themselves as sort of intersectional feminists, then I mean the proof's in the pudding. It's like, what has been done to acknowledge the whiteness in so many feminist spaces, and what way are white feminist organisations or businesses even, in what way are they acknowledging that gender is not the only, and in some cases primary, and some of the Indigenous women that I quote in the book, like Melissa Lukashenko said it 20 years ago, white racism is the main form of oppression that Aboriginal women face, not gender oppression, white racism, and there has to be that's where it has to build from. Mm. What do you think?
Yeah, that was interesting. I had a friggin' light bulb moment when I read that part, and the light bulb moment goes like this: after 7 years. You know, well, 7 years since I created it, the penny finally dropped to me as to why I called that bloody blog Rantings of an Aboriginal Feminist rather than Rantings of a Feminist Aboriginal. And to date, even though I've written a lot of pretty, you know, pretty hardcore feminist sort of writings, a great deal more of my writings have been focused on race, racism, the many forms that it takes, particularly in this country, and the need to unpack it constantly over and over again. And it is because, you know, when even you brought up progressive, so bringing up gender issues within progressive circles is hard enough. Because I think progressives make that assumption that because they're progressive, they're across everything and that's just the way it is. And when they find out that they're not, the defensiveness that can come with that, it can be really confronting. But yeah, learning that they're not across gender or they're not across race or they're not across a whole heap of other... Because my understanding, I don't know... intersectional feminism, yeah, global feminism, I totally get that. I just tend to bring it... my understanding of it is always, you know, these different structures of oppression and rungs on a ladder, and that's how I've been able to break it down, which is very much the ideas that you spoke about when you brought up Audre Lorde and then Kimberly Crenshaw and their unpacking of it, because it was about, you know, for me, feminism can't be of any use unless it's liberating the person who is oppressed by the most systems possible on the bottom of the ladder, because if that person is liberated, then everyone else who's on the rungs above them actually ends up benefiting from their liberation. Whereas if you're just liberating the people who are closest to the top, then you've still got all these people down here who are still struggling, and that includes, you know, women of colour. It includes a whole heap of other groups as well.
Yeah. No. You say this in the book as well, but I was thinking about it more in terms of the marriage equality referendum. Where white women. So a lot of the feminism they practice is to get white women on par with white men, and it kind of stops there. And I think in a different way, it kind of played out for me, like we watched it happen live with the marriage equality referendum, where it was kind of like you're going for the easiest possible, or for the like... Sorry, I'm probably not explaining that very well. So we can now marry each other, whatever, and then everybody else who is still... marginalised under this like queer banner is still being marginalised, but we've got the right to marry, so fuck it. And I feel like that happens a lot with whiteness as well, where it's like the affirmative action thing, right, where white women are the main beneficiaries of affirmative action, and it's kind of like, well, you know, we've achieved gender equality, so fuck it.
Yeah, and get this. So affirmative action in the US, white women are the greatest beneficiaries, and this is something that Kimberly Crenshaw also goes into in a later paper she wrote. The greatest beneficiaries of affirmative action, they're also the ones most likely to bring a lawsuit alleging that affirmative action is affecting them adversely on the basis of race. So... that is, and yeah. She gives statistics as well.
Yeah.
So we don't keep those kinds of statistics in Australia. That's why I used American ones for that section. But think about what that means. The most likely to benefit from it when it's on gender grounds, and also the most likely to
litigate
on the saying I've been racially discriminated.
Yes. Yeah, this is what I was saying earlier. So the start of I don't know what you call it, but on one of the starting pages, it starts with an Arabic proverb, "Darabni baka shtabani washtaka," which basically means he hit me and he cried, and then he ran to tell on me. Mm-hmm. Where it's that exact thing playing out, where it's like you've just punched me in the face, and now you've gone crying to somebody that you've somehow been victimized, and it's just that repeating, and you know, white women's tears. It's the whole, you know, I've done something, or I've abused you in some way, and now I'm going to claim victimhood. Mm.
So you're hitting them twice, basically.
Essentially, like,
you're hitting them twice.
I don't know how many people were following the Tanya Day inquest, but what struck me, I mean, a lot of that struck me personally, but there was one, so because I was following it on Twitter, somebody was talking about one of the Ambers who had been in the video shown to be like just dragging her like a rag doll and treating her mishandling her very badly, and she apparently stood up in court and started crying at the family, and then like according to the person tweeting minutes later was like chirpy again, where it's just like, you know, I've been abusing my power, and now I'm going to cry about it in hopes of absolving myself, in hopes that like the whiteness or the patriarchy will come save me and absolve me from my sins. And we see it played out all the time. Mm. I don't know where I'm going with this. I just wanted to bring it up.
I think, sorry.
No, please.
But I think in that case, you know, it becomes a performance, and it's a performance about someone's individual feelings. Mm. Rather than, because, you know, you go from Tanya Day over to Ms. Jew in WA, and she was pretty much dragged across the floor as well. You know, it's like this. Oh, I did this. I feel really bad. Acknowledge my badness, but then it plays out again. You know, another Aboriginal woman's imprisoned for you know, fines not being paid or public drunkenness or whatever, and the cycle just keeps on continuing again. So, it's kind of like, yeah, I can only see those sorts of instances as an individual performance, rather than anything that ever leads to change. Maybe that one person has a penny drop moment and then that's it.
Yeah, but it's not about individual responsibility. It's about systemic change. When we're talking about whiteness, we're talking about the whole system, not just one individual crying about it.
Mm. But there's an interplay between the personal and the systemic, or the individual and the systemic, and those sorts of performances are what helps, maintains the system, because they're always forgiven or brushed aside and be like, well, they didn't mean it. Oh, look, she's sorry. And there's no interrogation that needs to happen. Mm. And, you know, that's why I start with all that history, or I go into all that history, because you have to know it to know how that can still happen, how human beings can still be treated as if they're completely, you know, impervious to pain. We still treat that. And that's, you can see from, you know, I did follow some of that, some of the ways in which the Ambos and the police were talking about about Tanya Day was just as if she was just not capable of feeling things, and so they didn't have to worry about her, you know. And that's what I wanted to interrogate: where did that come from, and why? How does that relate to other, you know, women in other places, and how is it different? How does it, you know? And it's certainly in Australia much, you know, more targeted at Indigenous women. We know this simply by the fact that other women are not dying in custody. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, those kinds of attitudes are still reflected even in medical. I mean, I don't have much to do with the medical practice or industry, but I feel like I read somewhere that, I mean, they're still being taught that white people and non-white people have different pain thresholds, and it is rooted in this, like, original dehumanization. Well, they're not human. They're not.
Yeah. We're not. And people. Why? So that they can be exploited, right? Yeah. You know, so in terms of you know, with slavery, well, you know, Africans are less, they can't feel pain as much, so it's okay to work them to the brink and beyond the brink. They don't feel as much emotional pain, really, to their children, so we're okay when we take them away and you know, funnel their children into slavery. And so there's actually a reason, like a logical but completely messed up and horrific reason for that, and that is to allow the exploitation and allow to the dehumanisation for what ends? For economic gain.
Yeah. So I guess my question is, how do we hold them accountable for that? How do we hold... I mean, that's probably a big one, right? How do we hold white people and white women and whiteness, how do we keep it accountable? What do we do?
I'm not going to throw you on the spot. If you have something, say, because this is the hardest question. Like, you know, what is? I mean, I know I feel I'm jumping at any time if something hits you. Like, I end the book with a lot of questions that I direct at white women that I won't go into because, you know, it's a process. I arrive there, or borrow it from your library. Yes, I have these questions because I can't have all the answers, and I wish I did. And B, there has to be that process of interrogation by white people, and because this book is primarily about women, all women, by white women, and that can't, you know, that is fundamental to any sort of change, and I think the, you know, the as you started, this discussion is there has to be that step back from taking it all personally, and that any talk of racism or any even in indeed when a, if a woman of colour says to a white woman, you know, when you did that, like that was kind of messed up. Like, why did you do that? And that immediate sort of reaction of sort of defensiveness and why you're saying this, that can't really be addressed without that sort of stepping back of okay, what is being triggered here really? Why do I feel, as in, you know, I'm putting myself in the white woman's shoes here, why do I feel defensive? Why do I feel like I'm being attacked? And you know, the answer is because you're being forced to think about your privilege and you're aware of your privilege because you are now invoking it in order to sort of shut down the other woman. And of course it's going to shut down because her down because, you know, again, that sympathy is going to flow. And so, you know, Robin DiAngelo talks about in White Fragility. It's going to flow to her. And so what I wanted to answer in the book is why is it so easy for that to happen? Why is it so easy to paint an Arab woman as aggressive and a black woman as angry? And that's, you know, that the history is there. And it's not just a matter of, oh, well, it happened then and that's what's happening now. It's a matter of repetition again and again, generation after generation after generation, repetition against all spheres of life, you know, in public life, in private life, in literature, in music, in movies, in, you know, postcards. I used to make postcards, you know, like these images repeated again and again and again until they become so entrenched that they're just implicitly accepted that if you see, you know, a black woman or a brown woman with a white woman and they're conflicting and the white woman is upset, it's the that just kind of kicks into gear and it's the white woman who's going to almost certainly get the sympathy. Now, what I'm asking here is not to say that, not to agree the white woman's always wrong and you know, the brown or black woman is always right. Absolutely not. What I'm saying is we don't even have a fair hearing. We don't have a fair hearing. We can't even, even before we open our mouths, we're not really going to, at the way the world is now, be listened to. We want a fair hearing so that we can discuss our conflicts and our differences in a way that where people can honestly and genuinely look at the actual situation of what's happening before they make any sort of judgment.
I think the only thing that I'd add is that I've been in so many feminist spaces now, and one of the features of feminist spaces seems to be that when I've been on panels, not this one, because look at all of us with our colours, but when I've been on panels with that sort of, I was talking about, we were talking about intersectionality before and performative intersectionality. I've sat there and I've heard people individually name their various privileges. They've just sat there and gone, I'm a this, I'm a that, you know, I'm able-bodied, I'm heterosexual, I've got white privilege and all of that. And they've taken up 5 minutes just labelling their own privileges.
Like, thanks, here's a cookie.
Yeah, yeah. And I've seen it happen over and over again over the time that I've been speaking. But what I don't necessarily see happen is that then translate to a deeper consciousness. Feminism spent a lot of the 70s in consciousness-raising circles, talking about womanhood, the oppression via womanhood, and what they needed to do in order to elevate the status of women, you know. Even though it was limited, there was consciousness raising. That consciousness raising now needs to actually go a fair bit further than what it has because it's excluded big groups of women and it's excluded their right to speak up in this space. And when everyone's labelling their privileges but nobody is actually enacting that and breaking down those privileges, then they still remain. They don't actually ever change and the opportunity to fair hearing will never exist.
That's bleak. So we're going to throw to questions really quickly, or to audience questions in a minute. But before we do that, I kind of wanted to shift focus a little bit away from white people, because I don't know about you two, but I get so sick of talking about them. Good God. So we know that we won't get a fair hearing, and we know that whiteness doesn't give us space to breathe a lot of the time. So how do we, as people of colour, as First Nations people, as our individual
identities. How do we hold space for each other and engage in community care, and how do we make sure that we're okay decentering whiteness?
Like that, I mean, that's a really hard question. I'll be the first to admit I'm terrible at that kind of sort of self-care. When I was writing the book, I was in a pretty, like, not a great place, not just because of what I was reading and writing, but because the process that led me to it, the process that even led me to write that article. I mean, I wrote that article because that thing, had exact thing that I described, had been happening to me again and again and again. And it was like, what am I doing wrong? Do I need to be nicer? Is the way other people see me just so completely different? Am I deluded? Do I think I'm an okay person, but everyone else thinks I'm horrible? Like, and then I discovered other women were feeling that, and other women and other women. And then I started the book, and it was almost like this race against time of can I actually finish this before I just completely break down, because I'm struggling here. I was still struggling to sort of to come to terms with it all, and then of course I was like writing around the clock and reading around the clock, so I wasn't exercising, I wasn't eating right, which only added to it all. So I'm not the best at that sort of stuff. I need advice on the best sort of things to look after myself and to look after others. As well, but I do think in that sense, one thing the book might hopefully provide is at least some validation, some affirmation. You know, that is one of the reasons I wrote it. Because the response from so many women across the world saying, "You've just described my life, and I had no words, I had no framework through which to look at this, and I didn't realise what was going on, and now you know, I understand a little bit more." So. That's part of my hope for this book, is that at least maybe with some validation and to seek out other, you know, women of colour or other people that have those that can sort of validate our experiences in that way, where we can talk about these without fearing backlash, without fearing you know, being punished, which is what happens a lot of the time. We these things happen to us, and then we talk about it, and then we get punished again for daring to talk about it. And it's like, where do we turn?
Yeah, I don't know what else to add to that, because I'm terrible at self-care as well. I just went on a holiday, had an awesome time because I wasn't experiencing Australian colonialism for 3 weeks. Came back and within 2 days was having a meltdown on social media because there'd been a series of events, like, you know, racist security guards at Jaffarung, a death in custody, you know, all these other sorts of things that come together, and I'm just sort of, oh. So a good part of self-care, I think, for me, apart from getting the hell out of here on occasion, is also making sure that there is a dialogue, and I think and that you've got that sort of those supportive networks who are talking about the same sorts of things, they're interrogating them, unpacking them, and seeing how they impact our lives, because, you know, it is about building that sort of understanding. I could vent in a space of people who understood why it was that I would get so frustrated by what I'd seen within 2.5 days of getting back, and it helped me process it. But it is really, really tough. So my hope would be that, yeah, through like Ruby's book, through other writings of, you know, women of colour talking about these sorts of systems of oppression, that it actually leads to bigger dialogues, and instead of defensiveness, it leads to exchange and understanding.
Yeah, and that's why I finished the book with these questions that I'm posing to white women. It's like, you know, I ask all these questions, and I'm like, these are not rhetorical. Like, I want you to think about answering them, whether it's in articles or books or even just amongst your friends. Like, answer these questions, because then we might be able to have, you know, a more equal and fair dialogue.
Awesome. We'll open it up for questions now. Before we get to, I mean, feel free to raise your hand now, but I just want to be really clear about something. I'm looking for questions, not statements. Don't need a 3-minute even, like, context to your question. Like, just ask the question. That'd be great. With that being said, does anybody have questions? Awesome. There's a few up front.
Celeste, you mentioned consciousness raising with specific reference to white feminists. I'm wondering about consciousness raising within our own communities of colour, because I think quite often we can encounter, especially women of colour, who may have not experienced some of these issues or may choose through self-preservation not to notice these experiences. And it's a certain different type of defensiveness, because it's obviously a fear-based defensiveness. How do we encourage consciousness raising in those contexts in order to also preserve and keep safe our other people of colour in our communities?
Yeah. And I think about that, and that whole sort of where you do have those women who haven't interrogated it. You know, maybe it's because they've found some way in which they do experience some privilege. Maybe it's because it's really, really difficult to do. But I think it's just about continuing to have those spaces and those discussions and bringing them forward, and then hoping that it opens up more discussions and more exchange. You know, even bits and pieces that I've written, I've had, like, I think my very first piece was me criticising Aboriginal beauty pageants, for example. And there are Aboriginal women who felt attacked by me criticising them with an Aboriginal feminist lens on, because it was creating a space for women, and those individual women felt empowered. But, you know, my response to that was more about unpacking, well, this is why beauty pageants exist. This is why it's problematic, not just from a womanhood, but also from an Indigenous perspective, where we're being classified by skin colour for generations. We're being separated and all of that. And I tried to, you know, I tried to engage in a dialogue, and because of that, there was positive exchange, and there was an ability to actually have those sorts of discussions. I'm not saying that I've obliterated Aboriginal beauty pageants yet. I'm still trying, but you know that it does create a space, or trying to create those spaces where people can actually then go, hang on a minute, and start to look, and you are engaging in discussions and trying to keep them as safe as possible, affirming where, you know, where people are all of a sudden starting to break down what it is that not their defensiveness. I don't want their defensiveness affirmed, but I do want them to actually be taken through that journey and taken through it, you know, bit by bit. I don't even know if I've answered your question, but there is a lot of consciousness raising, because we do perpetuate sometimes racism, sexism within our own circles, because those are the dominant forms of power that we live with every day, and we do need to do a bit more and create the spaces that are safe to talk about it.
Yeah, I won't add too much to leave time for other questions. I mean, I write a devoted a chapter towards the end of the book on you know, how sort of whiteness can replicate and does replicate itself in the spaces of non-Indigenous and non-black people of colour, not just in settler colonies, but in, you know, countries around the world. And my, you know, what I was really trying to sort of, you know, analyse there is how, like, because, you know, whiteness created a binary, right? It was like white people and black people, essentially. And then everyone in between is kind of like also looked down on and treated with much, you know, inferiority and violence. However, they could appeal to whiteness in a way black people and Indigenous people could not, or can still not. And unfortunately, many do. And in a way of trying to escape the oppression, to scrape the lines, to be accepted. And I think that's kind of where it's important to start, is when is this happening, where is this happening? And in many ways, the way that the country and the system operates, it pushes us to that, you know? And I know I discussed the, you know, that putting citizenship ceremonies on Australia Day. That's a very pointed way of telling us, you're new here, you have to identify with us, with this, with the nation state, And that's going to come at the expense of that needed solidarity of First Nations people, you know, around issues like that. So it's a hard thing. And again, I mean, what I was really trying to do in that book is to let's get so much stuff that is buried and get it out, because it's only by talking, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to solve the problem with this book. This book is not meant to replace anything. It's not meant to be your one. As if you only read one book, you read this. No, like, you can't just read one book. That book, I reference so many people because I want people to go out and look them up and to be inspired to look up other writers as well.
There were other questions. I can't remember. Yep.
Firstly, Ruby, I want to really thank you for that article in The Guardian last year, because for the first time in a very long time, I felt my experiences validated, because I always thought those experiences were just me. And it used to have a huge impact on my mental health, not just in the way I perceived myself, but the way I operated in the world. So firstly, big thank you. My question is around the mental health of women of colour and how the conscious raising needs to address that, because it's about that resilience we need to build within our communities of women.
Yeah, I mean, I describe it as we're traumatized and re-traumatized, and we're essentially in, like, you know, the power dynamic is so stacked against us that it's essentially like being abused again and again, and not being able to have any recourse, because we are in a sense trapped in the system. And I mean, that's like, you know, as I said earlier, I'm so terrible at self-care and looking after myself and my mental health. In many ways, this book was quite difficult writing, but it was also a catharsis. And I think women, some of the women told me is that they get validation from seeking out other women, like from seeking out, boards and online, you know, forums where they can talk about these things and know that they're going to be listened to. And not, you know, be shouted down, not be punished again. And it's, you know, I'm just hoping that there can be some sort of acknowledgement that we are struggling in that way, and then that the effects and that the society is having on us. But I guess, you know, the way in which the article did impact so many women and they felt validated, well, then that's a key. Then we need to keep validating each other's experiences. We need to, you know, talk with each other and give that support. That's, you know, beyond that, I mean, it's about we have to take down the system. I mean, I wish I could tear it down. Which is not like destroy the whole country. Like, it's just, you know. Be sensible. I just know that, you know, if someone's going to, like, quote me on that, like, she wants to, like, just put, you know.
No, absolutely.
Tear let's down the whole, the you know, system. Let's destroy yeah. the system, you know.
I'm happy to be quoted on that.
Yeah.
Was there anyone else? Yep. I love how all the questions are conveniently coming, like, from close by.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So speaking to not talking for women of colour, but also not getting you to, you know, do racism 101 again and again and again. Where is the line between those two things?
Do you mean you as a white?
Yeah, so
woman? Yeah.
So not speaking for you while to sort of explaining things to other white people, but also not putting it on women of colour to explain everything.
Yeah. I need to watch my hand gestures. Do you have something?
I've knocked this as well, sorry. I think twice. Where is the line? It's a hard one to answer. I think that, last time Ruby and I appeared on stage together, we had a bit of a chat about the fact that we'd never appeared on stage together. Most of our inclusion had been about feminist panels being diverse, but the diversity went as far as having one woman of colour, whether it was the Arab woman or the Aranda woman, and that was their experience of intersectionality. So it just ends up we get brought in for special comments, and that's it. I think that the line is probably, instead of just assuming that an Aboriginal woman or an Arab woman or a black, brown, woman of colour, Indigenous woman, whatever else is there to be the diversity quotient, it's about flipping that and recognising that the experiences are important, and that it's about, and sorry, that the listening, the deep listening, there's a lot of, lot more, who have I pinched deep listening from? Sorry, I know it's, I know it's a black feminist. This is terrible little. But that whole idea about actually listening to what's being said and engaging in exchange rather than speaking for is probably more important than anything else to me. I spoke about the repetition before and the 101 and always coming back to that. And that's because we don't actually get listened to. Where it's speaking about, so where you're raising consciousness within your own circles, that's incredibly important. But it's good to back that up with then using whatever platform you can to elevate voices that represent what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I think we need to sort of keep in mind we want to work towards you know, a world where we don't have to have these particular discussions. And so what that also means is not only calling on women of colour and when it's time to talk about, you know, race. And I mentioned this, you know, at my book launch, and I was quoted incorrectly afterwards. What I said was, you'll know we're starting to get somewhere when you do have, you know, a panel like this where it's all, you know, non-white women, and we're talking about, you know, something, you know, climate or, you know, just climate change or although that is related to terrestrial colonization as well, that example. But, you know, mortgages, let's look at that. But again, that's also financial and that's related. Everything's related to race. I get it. Point being is that I still see, like, you know, I'm in a festival coming up, and I won't say which one it is because I don't want to, like, target anything or anyone in particular, but they've got a panel of you know, women from different backgrounds, women of colour and Indigenous women talking about their experiences. And then other issues that are just to do with sort of feminism more generally, like, you know, domestic violence and how far have we come, they're all white still. It's still happening, right? This is what I mean. Like, we still, there might be more of us speaking louder and having, even just having a panel like this was not something that would have happened even just a few years ago. However, there's still a bit of, you know, sequestering, a little bit of separation going on there. We need to be looked at as full human beings that have opinions not only on this. Obviously it's all related and comes back to it, but you know, honour that, honour our intelligence and our import and our humanity by across the board looking to us as maybe we can be sources of wisdom on lots of things.
Sorry, I'm going to just take one more question from the front, if somebody could bring a microphone. I know we're running very slightly over time, sorry. Just there.
Thanks. I had a question for Ruby. So going off your previous answer around having different relationships or access to whiteness when you're a woman of colour or a brown woman, which I find a really interesting conversation, I wanted to ask about your use of the terms in the book. And I haven't read it and I'm looking forward to reading it. But when did you feel like it was useful to generalise or to use the term women of colour? And when did you feel like it was useful to specify and say, I'm talking about black women here and that's important?
Right. So I actually start the book off with that, talking about the, you know, these terms and the use of the terms, and I acknowledge that they can be too generalising and imperfect. And so when I talk about, you know, being at the receiving end of white tears, that's something that I can say confidently, women of colour. And sometimes I'll say brown and black women, and maybe I'm erasing here, but I mean all women of colour when I say brown and black women. Again, it's imperfect terminology. So something like that I can feel confident saying, oh, woman, because I know that we can all experience that from no matter what our background. But, you know, when we're talking about and I mentioned earlier, high incarceration rates, death in custody, you can't use the term women of colour in that regard, because that is completely, that's not our experience, that's not our particular oppression. So that has to be, you have to be specific, and you've got a responsibility to be specific there. And the same with slavery, like, you know, that was a particular experience to black people, you know, slavery in the West, in any case. And so, yeah, it's really about, well, who am I talking about here? And how is talking about this, even though it's not the experience of women like me and not the experience of all women of colour, what is the... Why would I talk about it and relate it? You know, you don't want to talk about... You don't want to be exploitative and talk about it just for the sake of it. There has to be a reason. There has to be a thread. So if I'm talking about the... colonisation here, and of course it's specific to Aboriginal women, initial colonisation. However, everything that's happening right now comes from that, and that's when that thread or that connection has to be made, if that makes sense.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, great. We'll leave it there because we are super over time. I do want to thank everybody for coming, and a reminder that you will be signing books. I think I cannot see where it's set up, but it's probably, yep, in the back of the room. I can see the booksellers waving. Thank you, booksellers. Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you so much, ladies. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.